we decided, okay, we were going to compare her findings on British sign language poets with hearing pantomimes. And one of our first problems was finding the pantomimes, the mimes. I live in Switzerland. We have a very good friend, Dimitri, who is a professional mime, clown. And I went to him and I said, you know, give us a couple, you can't do it, you're too busy, give us a couple of your students. And he said, no, no, we don't do that kind of stuff now, we do clown stuff. It's really hard to find, at least for us in Germany and Switzerland, professional mimes who could do this. And miming, Dimitri told us, was sort of having a problem now because people associate mimes today with people doing things on the street, you know, shopping and then asking for money. Rachel and I thought, oh, what are we going to do? How are we going to get some pantomimes? Fortunately, we have other friends, a very good friend who lives in Los Angeles. Rachel happened to be for a year in America then. And so we both met in Los Angeles, where our good friend found some professional mimes in Hollywood. And that's why we filmed American mimes who had a lot of experience. Do you want to add anything to that, Rachel?
I think I would want to say that the quality of the mimes that we found was incredibly high. I'm no disrespect to the people in gold who stand on the street and ask you for money, but the mime artists that we were able to talk to, they have a string of Hollywood credentials. I've actually seen some of them in movies, although one was dressed as a monkey at the time, so I didn't actually recognize him. But these were very top quality people that Penny managed to find for us.
Yeah, or our friend did. And also, I know one of your colleagues who's not here, the woman in Montreal, is interested in dance. Two of our mimes had also studied dance. One studied Indian dance and the other another kind of dance. So there is that kind of element too with two of the mimes, but not with all of them. Okay, can we start now? Okay. Hello. Okay. I hope I don't talk too fast. As the interpreters know, I've got a lot of things I want to go through, although Rachel has wisely told me to eliminate a lot. But basically, what we're doing is we're comparing these two studies. Rachel's previous study that she did with her colleague Donna West on British Sign Language poets, and then our study that has been published here. And I'm not going to be talking about everything today that we talk about in this article. If you want details, you can read the article. Okay. Lost my mouse there. These are the themes that we'll be talking about. An introduction, description of the two studies, and then a quick overview of some of the major results, and then focusing in on some of the different techniques that were used, and then finally trying to relate some of the things we found or noticed to some cognitive and linguistic theories. What are the take-home points? One, a lot of you people, especially those of you, many of you who have studied sign language research or are native signers yourself, you'll be aware of a lot of the things that we're talking about, and you have probably talked about mime yourself when you've given lectures. But for us, it was interesting as sign language researchers to actually see what this mime was like. We found a lot of times that sign language researchers researchers often talk about pantomime. They say sign language is not pantomime, but often they don't know very much about pantomime. We didn't know very much about pantomime or mime. So we think it was interesting just to see, to collect this data and see what the pantomime, what the mimes do. Then we found out, of course there are many similarities between the sign artists and the mimes, but there are differences. And the aspect, let me move Rachel here. Rachel, you are over my last point. What am I going to do with you? I'll put you in the corner. Okay. Our main point is, and I'll come back to it at the end, is that the aspects that they develop and make are ones, it's not that they are so much different from what they can do, but it's in what they assume their audiences can understand. We have to be clear what's being compared here, what we're talking about. We're not talking about everyday signing and mime, okay? Although there are aspects of mime and everyday signing too. These studies are specifically comparing two artistic forms. They're comparing sign language poetry or artistic sign language and mime, okay? Now, let's look at these terms a little bit more closely. We know, we all know this. This is just a review. We know, we always say it in our lectures, sign languages are not mime. Why? Because sign languages have special conventionalized vocabularies. They have complex grammars. They have a broad range of uses and variants. They have communities of users. And I think it's also important that sign languages have to be learned. But, and this is the point that Rachel has been pointing out in a lot of her work, is there's a kind of a continuum between signing, mime, and gesture. And I think that's what interests most of us here today. And as Rachel and her colleagues have also pointed out, some forms of sign use very little established signs, conventional vocabulary, but they tend to use much more mime-like things. And this is the reason why she and her colleagues have found that many of the poets that she works with can be understood by signers who use different sign languages. Okay? Who use different sign languages. Okay? A more international audience. And so as a result, she chose to look at this kind of artistic signing on this continuum as more towards mime than conventional everyday signing. Okay, let's look, and I'm going to show this video a couple times and use it for different points. And you might have seen it before. I don't know if Rachel showed this at one of her other lectures here. This is a poem called Prince Looking for Love. It's a British sign language poem. I'll let you look at it first. Whoops. It's done by the BSL poet Richard Carter, and all these poems are available online also. Oops, it's not moving. Prince Looking for Love. Okay. Now, you know, we probably have different levels of understanding. It's obvious he's talking about a frog here, or frogs. And many of us know the fairy tale about the princess kissing the frog and the frog turns into the prince. Okay, it's based on that sort of thing too. Okay. Now, so it's obvious, wait a minute, if we're looking at this, that there are elements of mind in it. Did you all understand it all? I know the deaf people probably did. Yeah, okay. If you show it to just a non-signer, for example, my husband, what did you get out of that? What? Some humor, but you knew what you saw was about frogs. Okay, after you said it. Okay, see, he's useful in the audience, okay. Also, when we talk about sign mime, it's interesting to keep in mind a term called visual vernacular, which you might be aware of too. It was coined by Bernard Bragg, a very famous American sign language poet. And this is what he says. He was talking about how Bernard, how Marcel also invited him to study with him, and he created another technique based on this method. He says it's not really a traditional mime structure. He's changed it into a smaller frame size and utilized film techniques, used cuts and edits, close-ups, long shots, and he calls the whole thing visual vernacular. Another well-known study by, or text by Bauman, 2003, further describes these. And another very interesting study by Koneshita in 2005 talks especially about the cinematic features, and especially the frame of the visual vernacular. These are things you're probably all familiar with. Here, this is just once again a reminder, there are things that are very common between mime. To the left is one of our Hollywood mimes, Don, and to the right is the poet. And you can see the faces are very similar in depicting these frogs. Okay, now let's talk about pantomime. We talked about sign language. We're talking about this artistic form of sign language. What about pantomime? We found out very quickly there's no one universally accepted definition of pantomime. In fact, nobody can really tell us if there's a difference between the terms pantomime and mime. We couldn't find any consistent differences anyway. Then you've got different kinds of mimes, as you might know. You've got mimes, especially historically, that were done with words. And you've got other kinds of mimes that are done without words or sounds. So those are two different kinds of schools. In some schools of mime, the face is very important, Marcel Marceau, for example. In other schools of mime, Étienne Decouat, for example, a very famous, I think, Parisian mime, he has something called corporal mime, where the face is not important at all. In fact, I think they often perform with masks over their face. Yeah. So that's another school of mime. Then some mimes use props, other mimes do not use props. There's two schools that you make the distinction between objective and subjective mime. Objective mime is what we think of when we think of Marcel Marceau, you know, someone walking up the stairs, how objects affect us, how wind affects the body. Subjective mind is more aimed at portraying states of the soul, of the spirit, this sort of thing. So they're two different aims. And then what are they trying to do as they build up their mime skits? Some people want to give you a story, a short story, a vignette, and others, there's another whole school of mime that focuses on political messages. So there's a great variety of mime and pantomime. You have to be very clear, or we as sign language researchers have to be very clear when we talk about mime, what are we talking about? What are we comparing sign language to? Okay, so for this study, we found for our poets and our mimes that they're more Marcel Marceau-like, more like modern mimes. They all use the face. And they use the body, of course, working in space. The mimes especially use no words. And the signers use fewer conventional signs. And they're not interested so much in political messages, but more expressing poetic ideas. Okay, we'll look at all of these. But here, we just want to refine and make sure you, our research question, and make sure you understand what we're doing. If we assume, with as one mime has said, mime is not acting without words, but is acting beyond words. And if we assume that sign poetry also goes beyond normal signing, then our question becomes, how does highly visual creative work of sign language poets compare to the highly visual creative work of mime artists? That's what we're looking at. They both use the same articulators in space, and there's also a great deal of iconicity, which is hiding behind Rachel here. But anyway, that's that word behind her there. Okay, I keep losing my mouse here. There we go. Okay. Talking about iconicity, I think there's one particular model. There are many models of iconicity, as we all know. This is a whole seminar in itself. But we found very useful Sarah Taub's analog building model of iconicity. You might be familiar with that. It was her dissertation, and she's written a book on it. Sarah Taub says that iconicity is not an objective relationship between the image and the referent, between a sign or a gesture for a tree and the real tree, but between mental models of both of these. For example, well, yeah. And then she also goes on to talk about, let me go back a bit here. I have seemed to have lost a slide, okay. She also talks about stages of creation of a sign, iconic sign. You start out with a conceptualization of it. Then you do an image selection. You tend to look at prototypical features. For example, a tree, you think of a trunk, you think of limbs, you think of leaves, you think of the ground. And then you choose in schematization, you choose those features that can be represented by the art form that you're using. And then you, in signing, you encode them into the articulators you're using, your face, in your arms, in your hands, in your trunk, to some extent. There are differences in the conceptualization, perhaps, but I think also especially in the schematization and the sign encoding, that's where we'll find a lot of differences between mimes and the signed artists. What are the implications of this? The implications are it's possible that there are different choices available for the artists, for the poets, and for the mimes in this, these steps of encoding iconicity. And this is our main point, a lot of it will depend upon what the artist thinks the audience can understand. Assumptions about that. So, there are two aims in this studies, both of these studies. One is we're interested in what they come up with, these two groups of artists, but we're also very interested in the way they build up their performances, their thinking as they do it, okay? So, these are the two studies, as I said before. The first, I'm gonna talk about just briefly the methodology of the studies. You are familiar with Rachel's deaf poet study, probably. She used four very experienced British sign language poets who were not trained in mime. They had no training in mime. It was filmed in a private home in Bristol, I think in 2009. Is that right, Rachel?
Yeah, right at the end, maybe 10, but around then.
All right, I forgot to check with you on that. Okay, not too old. Okay, what happened? What did she do? She gave them a list of words for 10 animals, 10 abstract objects, and 10 abstract qualities. And then their task was to make these human, to anthropomorphize these. They were free to work up their responses by themselves or to work with other people. The entire three-hour session was videotaped, and a transcription was made of these video, of these comments, and of what happened in these sessions. These are the objects, animals, and qualities. The object, I think, the animals. You can correct me here, Rachel, but I think the animals they were chosen because they showed a lot of different shapes and forms, the objects also, in different possibilities of finding features that you can use. Is that what you would say?
Yeah. If I can say here, we chose them particularly because one of our questions was going to be, how do these use sign language?
Yeah.
So although it was partly to do with their form, it was also because we thought they would create different opportunities for the poets to think, how might these animals or objects sign? And that was why we chose, if you think about the form of those creatures,
yeah,
okay, that would affect how they would sign.
Okay, so this was the reasoning behind that methodology. The abstract qualities, I think you said, you took from a list of abstract, frequently used abstract English nouns. I think that was the reasoning behind that. Okay, lost my mouse again. Then, also important was the whole idea of shared thinking protocols. Are you familiar with that? This is something that Rachel and Donna West used in this study. They wanted to, shared thinking is like what they define as a collective form of think aloud protocols. You're asked to solve a task, but you're asked to verbalize what you're thinking as you solve it. And these kinds of shared thinking protocols then was done as a group. I think it was interesting to see how both the poets and the mimes thought about this, because usually a lot of times artists develop these things on their own, okay? And this is what one deaf poet said about thinking aloud versus what he normally does when he works up a signed poem. He said, "I feel when we're here in this workshop environment discussing ideas, it's very different from standing on a stage and performing. On stage, I'm not actively thinking, how am I going to do this? I just switch to performance mode and improvise. But here, we're actually trying to think about that process, which is very different." And I just think that's an interesting, we're asking them to do something that they don't normally do. And I suspect that probably the mime said something similar, I don't remember, but. Okay, the hearing mime study, let me move. I'm sorry, my mouse is just. You just have to believe me what I'm saying. You're covering up half my slide here, Rachel, but look pretty.
Get rid of me if you want. Turn me off. I can still see you.
Huh? I'm saying Rachel's covering up half of my slide. She should look pretty. Okay. The hearing mime study. As I said, we used four hearing mimes who had no knowledge of sign language, although two of them had knowledge of dance. They were filmed in a small studio we rented in Los Angeles. They were given the same group of concepts. They were also encouraged to comment as they worked up their episode, their skits. It was videotaped, and most of the spoken remarks and the annotations on the on what they actually did was notated in Elan, E-L-A-N, which Okay, let's look now at some of the major results or major areas of results that we found from this comparison. And this is what we're going to be looking at, how they responded to the tasks, multiple characters, whether they communicated with language or not, abstract qualities, and how they did lying, negating, etc. Okay. One thing we found, a very big difference, was that the sign poets very quickly moved into the task of building up a narrative. In other words, you said, you gave them something like a lobster, and they'd say, okay, now the lobster could do this and this and this, or they could make a story around it. The mimes, on the other hand, spent a lot of time at the beginning talking about a whole process of anthropomorphizing something. How much should you stay human? How much should you become an animal? You have to make a decision on that. Are you an animal-like human or a human-like animal? And it makes a difference with how you're going to build up your skit. And they also found, they spent a lot of time trying to find the essence of, for example, the object or the animal. For example, of the mime's frog. Here is a, I'm gonna have to move. Well, maybe I can keep him there. These are the mimes, and this is Don.
Frog, we could start.
Wait a minute. I have to tell you what Don is saying because it's going to be difficult for the interpreters. Don is saying here, a frog. We can start with finding the rhythms, tempos, movement patterns, and the basic essence of a frog, and creating the body too. We can start with the actual animal and find the actual shape, and then evolve it up slowly from a frog to a frog-like person. And I come up slowly with the idea of George Burns. Do you know who George Burns is? He's an American performer from the 50s and 60s on TV. And he had a cigar, and he was always getting little bits of tobacco in his mouth. He's taking tobacco out. And he had frog-like movements. And then he says, and then you can tone this up or down. Okay, I'll let you see what how he does this now.
You know, finding the rhythms, tempos, and basic essence of a frog, and, you know, creating the body too, you know, that, you know, the rhythms, movements of a frog. So we can start with the actual animal and find as much of the shape and the rhythms and tempos and movement patterns, and then what I would do is evolve it up slowly from a frog into, let's say, a frog-like person. And I come up with maybe George Burns, for example, was that, you know, had a, his cigar was, you know, he's getting little pieces of tobacco out. And he has a frog-like movement, and then you can tone it down or...
Okay, you get the idea. This is what the mimes did. Okay. I'm sorry, Okay. This is another example of what mimes did trying to find the essence of objects, for example, of spoons. The mime Emily made a very sensuous spoon. She laid on the floor and her arms were out as the bowl of the spoon offering something. Lauren at the back was a really laid back spoon, and he was the one, he did one of the few things showing kind of like the form of a spoon by putting his arms behind his head, and this was the whole form of the spoon. And then Dennis in the middle, he thought the essence of a spoon was offering something, and this was his essence of the spoon. And then Don was both offering and open, his whole body becomes the face and the arms become the spoon. This is an example of how the difference between going into the essence of something by the mimes and the poets moving right into doing a story. And here they're talking about a spider. And there's talking about the spider could be good hanging from the ceiling. And then you'll see this. I'll show you the poet to the to your right will say, yes, it's like a housekeeper with a huge ring of keys at her waist, and she's running around locking things up. And then someone said, what's that? What's that round thing? I said, oh, it's a housekeeper with a big ring of keys, and all the legs can lock the doors as she walks around. Or it's a hotel where a ball is, and the spider shows the guests to their rooms, and there are 8 rooms. So the guests all follow the spider to the corridor, and the spider unlocks all 8 doors at the same time, because he's got 8 legs, okay? So this is the spider. She's asking, what's that ring? It's opening all the doors at once. Okay. Okay, another big difference is whether or not you can show multiple characters. The sign poets can show many characters and switch rapidly between them, but of course to understand this, you have to be able to understand sign language. The mimes, on the other hand, when they're working alone, show almost no multiple characters, maybe because it makes it more confusing for the audience. They tended to stick to one character throughout their whole performance. If they started as a spider, they stay a spider for the whole episode. And if they do more than one character, they tend to work with another mime. Two mimes working together can show multiple characters. These are two examples. On the left-hand side, that's a sign poet. First of all, he talks about a person polishing a mirror, and then he talks about how the mirror reacts to being polished. And that's a quick switch between being the mirror and being the person, polishing the mirror and being the person and being the mirror. On the other side are two mimes mirroring, doing a mirror, and one is the person looking into the mirror and the other is a reflection. But it takes two mimes to do this. This is another one of a pencil sharpener and a pencil. I'll let you look at this.
And it ended in...
Yes, if you want to make it part of the skit. Okay, so I'm thinking this is a pencil.
I'm thinking this is a pencil.
But I'm kind of tired.
Well, then she says, I'm getting tired. Okay.
Well, we could sharpen you as a pencil. I could be the sharpener and you could... volunteer to stick your head in, and we could, you know, so that's pretty literal, but and the pencil could get sharp, and then you could have a point.
All right. The,
I have to stand on my hands.
This is the problem here, of course. If she starts out and she's the pencil dancing on the floor, which is the paper, and then Don says, well, I could be the pencil sharpener. You can put your head in. She said, yeah, but my feet are where you have to put it in. I could stand on my head and put my, but you know, if you're going to be consistent with your picture, this would be her problem. And this is a problem with mimes. They have to be very aware of what the physical requirements are of their episodes. This is a poet talking about pencils and sharpeners. This is putting his head in.
Off.
rubbing his nose on the paper, getting dull again. Okay. There's a very big difference here between how the mimes do it and how the poets do it, okay? Let's talk about the linguistic communication between the characters. The mimes have no linguistic communication. Marceau had said, dialogue is not within our range. And when they do interact, they use only nonverbal communication. The sign poets, on the other hand, do a lot of linguistic communication, and they do this often on the mime end. Rachel, you might have to help me here, on the mime end of sign poetry by taking conventionalized signs and then adapting them. For example, if you want to talk about an octopus signing the sign, the BSL sign old, and I think the BSL sign old is made like this, is this right? Like this, okay, old. But of course, an octopus can't do that. And so what these poets decide to do is they say, okay, you could use a tentacle for each part of this sign, and you could do old like this. So they could have the characters communicate linguistically with each other, but by adapting in a mime-like way conventional signs. Sometimes both the poets and the mimes use nonverbal communication. For example, for the spoon, which doesn't have any limbs that it can sign with, the poets decide it communicates only by its face. And as we saw also, that's what the mimes did too. There's a lot of non-linguistic interaction between characters in this frog. Prince looking for love that I showed you before. How are we doing for time here? I'm going to have to move Rachel again. Okay, first of all, he's identified again now. When we look at the frogs here, we have the frog, we have some form here, we've got the frog, a very handsome frog, and there's another frog over here, a not very handsome frog. Oops, we lost something. I just lost my, Okay. I'm gonna have to go through and find where I was before. I think what I might not press my luck and try to show that to you again right away. I want to show you what some of the mimes are doing and how they use nonverbal communication. They interacted at what they called their animal cocktail party. They each took an animal, and they pretended they were at a cocktail party, which was a very human sort of thing to do. And this is what that looks like. Get my.
Move me, Penny.
Yeah. I'll move you, mm-hmm. Yeah. There you go, bye.
Bye.
Okay, she's a monkey. He's a crab, I think. Got a chicken coming here. And the guy in the red shirt is a snail. Okay, that gives me an idea of how the pantomimes would do this, also with nonverbal communication. Sorry, I just can't. Okay, we've got a squash thing here. Okay, looking at how they dealt with the whole problem of these abstract qualities, the sign poets had a lot of difficulty with this at first, but Rachel reports that they did have different, some kinds of solutions. For example, for confidence, again, maybe Rachel will have to correct my sign for this, but let's pull her up here. Can you show us how confidence is made in BSL and how they, okay, and how the poets did it? So it's raising the confidence up, taking a sign and then pulling it up.
It was on a balloon. It was in a hot air balloon.
Okay. Gets even more complicated. Or they also can show it with their face. For example, they had a whole story about house and the house being envious of the other house. So they showed this with their faces. What do the mimes do for abstract qualities? They also show it with their face, like the woman here showing envy on her face. But the guy in the red is showing different kinds of abstract qualities coming from a repertoire that many mimes have from Dukwa's mobile statuary, where he had a set of something like 40 human qualities that he paired with specific poses. They were not movements, they were poses usually, like arrogance or pride or anger, etc. And so they would fall back on that to show their abstract qualities. What about lying and negating and showing ambiguity? Of course, the sign poets have no problem with this. They can just use a sign for it. He's lying, or that's not true, or imagine something. The mimes don't ever deal with lying or negating or showing or this kind of ambiguity. In fact, this is a very interesting quote from Marcel Marceau. He says, "One cannot mime, this is not my mother. This is my mother-in-law." To say that, one uses a poster, or one writes it out or something, or one doesn't even use the mother-in-law. It's very difficult to show this non-linguistically. So mimes very rarely do this. I want to go quickly, because we're moving right along in time here, on some differences in the techniques used. And these will be Penny. Familiar to you too. Yeah?
You need to move me, Penny.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm wondering what you're seeing there. Okay. Okay. We're going to talk about frame of movement and some other techniques that you'll be familiar with from sign language research, from Kuksak und so weiter, and people like that. Frame of movement. You're probably all aware of this. This is just a kind of review of it. The mimes use their whole body. Their feet and their legs are important. The sign poets use the upper body and the arms, and they almost never use their feet and legs. And this makes an important difference in what they can and do. Another important difference is the mimes use the whole stage. A big space, both horizontally, moving back and forth, left and right, but also vertically, down on the floor, up on the ceiling. This is in contrast to signing windows. As you know, this is a very small space, and you don't usually go beyond it, and the sign poets don't seem to do this either. So this is an example of fingers moving across with a poet to show a spider moving, in contrast with the mime, who actually has. I'm not going to talk too much. These are some of the techniques that are different. Something that many of us have probably all noticed, but just to remind ourselves what the mimes do here on the right, if they want to look portray an elephant, for example, they use what Cuxac would call a whole body transfer. Other people have called role or constructed action. Whereas the poet will transfer this to his this body part to his hand, and this is of course a big advantage for the poets. Another thing that the poets do that the mimes do not do is what's called partitioning of signing space, or using two, what Cuxac would call two transfers simultaneously. Here, this is a sign poet who is portraying, whoops, Rachel's in the way again. Let's see. The body is a tree. Let me go back here. The body is a tree, and the hand is the axe cutting it. So it's a person transfer. And what would you call that? Was your... Yeah, double transfer, okay. And what is interesting is that, the poets use this a lot. Here is another example from Rachel's data. This is a child putting eyeliner on a doll. And then in the second picture, the hand is putting the eyeliner on, but the face is out of the doll. So this is one of these double transfers. As I say, this is something that the mimes use almost not at all. We've only got two examples of this in our data. This is of Don putting his head as a pencil into a pencil sharpener. So he's the sharpener and the pencil. And Emily, she is dancing, but she's assuming the floor is paper. I mean, it's kind of a double transfer, but she's being a pencil dancing on the floor. What I think is more interesting for us in this, I mean, as interesting, is different kinds of classifier forms or transfers that are used by these two groups. You know, there are these handling and instrumental classifiers who show how you handle an object or how something is used. And then there are what some people call whole entity classifiers, for example, the American Sign Language classifier for car, which is this, or yours in the Swiss one, this one example. And they are used very differently by the poets and the mimes. What's interesting here, I think, is that there are two different scales involved, and you might have thought of this yourself first, but we found it interesting. The body parts in the person transfers involves a one-to-one scale. The body is the body, the part is the part, the arm is the arm. Where in whole entity transfers, only a part of the hand is important. Only the hand, not the whole arm, is important. So you're reducing an object very much to a very small scale. Now, this has consequences, probably, for the audience. The person looking at this has to know how to look at it, has to know how to interpret it. If someone's putting his arm up, you have to know, do I look at the whole arm and the body, or is it just the hand that's important? So you have to know what scale is being used. And this is probably something that has to be learned. And it's probably something that's cognitively, we suggest, more complicated. So what do we have comparing the sign artists and the mimes? You've got mimes who can use a lot more space, high and low and wide and forward and back on the stage, but they can only show one character. And then you've got sign poets who use much less space, but they can show multiple characters from multiple perspectives, sometimes simultaneously. So it's kind of a trade-off. And I'd like to go now to the final section before we get to a more general discussion, talking about some theories of linguistic and cognitive knowledge that might be related to this. The most obvious difference between the mimes and the sign poets is the sign poets do have the tool of a lexical vocabulary if they choose to use it. They can choose a sign, and then even if they want to transform it, like old, but they do have an access to that where the poets don't, the mimes don't. This is clearly related to the linguistic problem of establishing clear reference. What am I referring to? The poets can quickly say, I'm talking about a spider or whatever, identify, oh, sorry. I have to move Rachel again here. Ah, there we go. The poets can quickly identify a referent by a sign, say what it's about, and the mimes have to build up this reference over a longer period of time. And maybe this is why we see this difference in the response to the tasks. When the poets were asked to anthropomorphize these things, they could quickly move into making little stories because they had no problem in clearly establishing what the reference were in their stories, whereas the mimes needed longer. And so they very rarely had time to build up stories like this. However, both the mimes and the poets can draw on something that I'd like to talk about just quickly in a little bit more detail, shared cultural knowledge and shared general knowledge of iconicity. Influence of shared cultural knowledge we found was important for both groups. The American mimes, for example, in this, the American mime I showed you earlier, when he was developing the essence of a frog, he says, this is like George Burns. Well, you have to be an American of a certain age to know who George Burns was, or you would not get this. At one point when Don, the mime, talks about being a pencil, and he comes out of the pencil sharpener, and he does this, which just, he does this. He comes out of the pencil sharpener, and then he makes this movement. As if to say, now the pencil has a point, but as also you have to know the English expression to make a point. And it, so it has these kinds of cultural linguistic knowledge you have to have. Emily, when she was asked, the mime, asked to portray a star, she wanted to portray a star, she looked like this, I'll show you. Okay, we were filming this in Hollywood, and for her, this was clearly, oh, a star is a Hollywood star, is a movie star. And so she was portraying, this was to her a way of anthropomorphizing this. And of course, something else we noticed with a lot of the mimes, if they want to portray, or even the poets portraying things like submarines, we know from Disney movies, from our culture of watching Walt Disney movies, that submarines can have eyes, that teacups can dance. Now, we're used to this kind of a culture, and this is something we share, and this is something the mimes today can draw on as a cultural knowledge. The deaf poets also draw on deaf culture. For example, when they are portraying a light bulb, at one point, they tap, like a deaf person taps another deaf taps to get attention in order to turn the light bulb on or off. And this has to do with this, what you do in a deaf culture. And at one point they were talking about what this monkey was, and they were portraying it kind of as a mainstream deaf person, that it has a lot to do with educational politics in deaf culture to get these kinds of illusions. Okay, so that's the influence of shared cultural knowledge, some examples. But also I find very interesting is the iconicity. And here I go back to one of my old favorites, which is George Lakoff and Johnson's idea of the metaphors underlying not only much of our linguistic knowledge, no matter what spoken language you use, but also many gestures, I think, and gesture systems. And this has been the basis of a lot of my work on gestural systems, has been looking at the underlying metaphors. And you all know this, but just to remind you, we have many shared metaphors. Upwards often is associated with something brighter, happier, lighter. Downwards is something heavier, darker, sadder. Eyes, especially in many cultures, are used for seeing, but they're also used as a metaphor for understanding. In English, you can say, oh, I see your point. I see what you mean.
I see your point. I just choose to do it not in a separate
okay.
English, sign language. So it's,
okay.
I see your point.
I see your point, which means I understand you. So that's in spoken language. And you have the same things, of course, in French, and we have them in German. We can give all kinds of examples. That's one kind of a general knowledge that we have that I think also underlies many of our gesture systems and ways gestures are used. Co-speech gestures, conducting gestures, and mimes. Another thing that is important is the different kinds of iconicity. We've got something called a motor iconicity, which is where you show what something's, you do something to show what's happening, like you show hammering. And then you have form iconicity, for example, showing the whiskers of a cat. That's showing the form or showing the motor actions. We know from other research that deaf children, tend to use action-based signs, handling signs, before they use size or shape, much less whole entity signs. In other words, they will act things out more, whole person kinds of things, before they will do handling, and before they do things very much later, these whole entity classifiers. I've done some work with my colleague Virginia Volterra in Rome, showing Italian signs to hearing and deaf people of seven different European cultures. And we find also that the hearing people... Volterra from Rome and colleagues, where we showed Italian signs to people who didn't know them, in different deaf and hearing people in different cultures. And it was interesting that the hearing people tended to interpret these signs. They didn't know what they meant, but they tend to give them action-like meanings, interpretations, almost universally. And only the deaf people would go so far as to say something wasn't just drinking, but it meant bottle or water or something like this. And then, of course, in conducting gestures, we find the same things. And my husband and I will be talking about that tomorrow. Okay, what's interesting here with the mimes and the poets is that the mimes use many more handling gestures than size or shape gestures, and they used no whole entity gestures at all. If they combined, in Kuczek's terms, they combine transfers, they'll combine a person transfer, a role, with a handling gesture, but that's it. For example, you would hold the flower and then you react to the flower. And some mimes explicitly warn against using descriptive gestures. They somehow feel this is much more difficult for the audience to understand. Okay? This is interesting. So, why is this widespread preference among children learning a language, non-signers using gesture systems, for using person transfers or handling, and for not using so much, showing form so much, or whole entities as assigned poets do? Our Italian colleagues have pointed out that it's basically a problem of an access to the intended meaning, and that they might be the form descriptors and the whole entity classifiers are probably more encoded than the handling gestures. And I go back to this point I made before about the different scales you have to look at. If you're looking at a whole entity gesture, you have to know, okay, I just have to look at the hand. And you have to know that. And you have to learn that, okay? And normal hearing people don't learn that in their normal life. Here, I'd like quickly to make reference to Barcelos' ground cognition theory. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but we found it helped explain some things in our study. He uses the term simulation, which he defines as the reenactment of perceptual, motor, introspective states acquired during experience with the world, body, and the mind. That's how he defines this. Now, important here is that you have to have repeated experience over time to build these up. And we know that human beings have lots of experience handling things all the time, from the time they're very small babies. The other thing is importance of context, what he calls situated conceptualization. He gives the example of a coffee bean. If you want to conceptualize a coffee bean, he says that activates all kinds of situations. For example, you imagine the espresso machine, you imagine putting the water in, you imagine how it smells, you imagine it coming out. You imagine the whole situation that's involved in this. This reminded us of something that one of the mimes told us about Marcel Marceau. This mime had studied with Marcel Marceau, and the task was to show a flower. And the mime said he went and he showed a flower. It took about 2 seconds. And Marcel Marceau said, no, no. And the mime just quickly showed a flower like this. And Marcel Marceau said, no, 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 no. This, you got to do much more than this. Okay. What you have to do maybe is you have to first look at the flower and then you show your reaction to it, how much pleasure you have looking at it. And then maybe you pick it, and then maybe you smell it, and you admire it in your hand, and then maybe you give it to somebody else. You unfold a whole situation, a whole sequence of actions. So the question comes, if sign poets can do all of this, they can do the mime, but they also can use lexical items, why do they bother to use mime? And I think... Okay, but why? Okay, the question is, if the mimes can do all of this, they can not only do this mime-like stuff, but they also have access to using signs for quickly identifying reference. Why do they bother to use mime? They can just tell things. And I it's clear that in an artistic text, your aim is not just to say clearly what it is you're talking about. That's not what makes it artistic. You want to play with ambiguity. You want to play with double meanings. This idea of the, I have a point, you know, the pencil making a point. You know, what does he really mean? It means both of these things. And there's lots of examples of that in mime. And it's important... I think for the mimes told us when they saw at the end, we showed them some sign language poems, and they said, they're doing it all so fast, they have to take much more time. And it seemed to us that in the artistic, when the sign artists do take time, and when the mime artists build up their sequence, is that they are kind of using this situated conceptualization that we're all familiar with as human beings, and they're making it into an art form, and they're using that as a basis of the art form. So the concluding thought is the difference between mimes and sign poets is not so much from what they can do. They both can do all of this if they have access to the language and the mime, but to what they assume their long audiences can understand. And the deaf poet assumes that his audiences or their audiences will have some of these knowledge of these sign language techniques, and the mime artist doesn't. And I would like just to conclude by looking at the frogs one last time and look at some of these techniques that were used. For example, at the very beginning, he says what he's talking about. He says, the frog looking for love, a prince looking for love. So he uses lexical signs. Now this, for example, a mime could do this probably. This is like a whole person transfer, okay? This probably a mime wouldn't do. these sort of form, showing the form of the frog. And here, what he did just now, he looked away and he quickly changed the character. He changed between the handsome frog and the ugly frog. A mime would not do that. A mime can't show these, cannot make these rapid transfers like that. And now he's going back to the handsome frog really quickly. This is the ugly one. And then this is something a mime would never do. This is using one of these whole entity classifiers. Up someone, we don't know who, is approaching. And we use our cultural knowledge to know, ah, maybe it's a princess, or, you know, we know the fairy tale. Okay. And then he does a rapid change of characters here. Okay, this is the person picking up the ugly frog. Now this part here, picking it up, is something, a whole person transfer that a mime could do. This is something a mime could do. This part here, not. Makes a sign up there, I think, of a fly or something, and then with the tongue flipping out, he's using his finger to show the tongue. A mime would not do that. A mime would use his tongue to show his tongue. This is the handsome frog. He's kissing, okay, now he is, this is such a rapid transfer. Okay, now I'm going to talk about the handsome frog. The person now is reaching down to pick up the handsome frog, kisses it, and it becomes the love of his life forever. Anyway, just so you can see how the different techniques that the sign poet has access to that the mime doesn't. Okay, Rachel, do you want to add anything there? Did I get it right?
Yes. So, well done, Penny. Very good. I would like to add that Penny's BSL was very good, and she gets 10 out of 10 for her BSL. But I would like to add...
My name, Penny.
She was talking about the project.
Yeah.
That although we probably all think it's very visual, when I've shown this to non-signers, they, like, as Penny said, Turing only knew it was a frog when we told him. That opened the context for hearing people. So when they know, oh right, it's a frog, then they can understand it. What was very interesting when I've shown it to non-hearing signers, I've had a range of reactions. One was, goodness me, I was 100% from understanding anything. So some people understood nothing. And some people said, oh yes, there was someone happy, there was someone sad. So they did get the facial expression. But interestingly, very few understood there were two frogs. And I think this shows what Penny was saying, that this idea that the audience can't keep up if they don't have that contextual experience. And they were falling back on what they know of the story, that the princess kisses the frog and the frog turns into the handsome prince. They didn't see, nobody saw that there were two frogs. And yet for people who know sign language, who recognize those shifts, it's very clear that there are two frogs. The hearing non-signers thought it was one frog that was sometimes happy and sometimes sad. And so I think that was quite an interesting difference that reinforces this point that a lot of it is what the audience can handle.
Mm-hmm. And in our reading and talking with mimes, it was interesting in how aware the mimes were at what their audience could handle and what they didn't allow themselves to do because of that. Okay, does our interpreter need a break? Okay, we'll give it a 5-minute break, and then afterwards, I mean, Rachel will still be here, and we really would like to discuss this with you and get your ideas and feedback.
Thank you.
Here. Can you see her?
Hi, Rachel. Hello. Okay. I have a short question about the question of rhythm. Since we have focused on the question of the visual creative art, and during the comment of one of the American mime, he has told that to become the frog, he has to first to think about the tempo and the rhythm of the frog, and then to become the frog. And I was wondering if during your experiment with the signers, the deaf poets, they mentioned the question of rhythm, since it made me think about a narrative in Quebec sign language we studied with Chris Miller, his sign is this. It was the narrative of the rabbit and the turtle.
Tortoise and the hare.
And the hare.
Yes.
And the contrast between the two characters was both significant in the kind of use of space, but also with the rhythm in their way of moving. And it make me think about this during the comment of the mime.
Okay, good. Well, that's a question for you, Rachel.
Okay, I'll wait. Okay, thank you. Yes, the poets, when they were talking about this creativity, they didn't mention rhythm explicitly. They never said, now let's talk about rhythm. But they were very clear that the speed of movement was important. So, for example, you may remember that one of the animals was a snail. Another animal was a tortoise, and the poets spent a long time talking about how they would move with the speed, so that the snail could communicate, but it would communicate slowly. The tortoise could sign. He would sign like this, but he would sign slowly. The octopus definitely had a rhythm of movement according to the way that an octopus legs would move. So we have a sign in BSL to tell a lie. And the octopus did this. So the movement of one tentacle had the rhythm of the octopus movement, and they were very focused on that. So yes, they were aware of it, but they didn't explicitly talk about it, but they did think very carefully about both the rhythm and the speed of the movement according to, I guess we could say, according to the essence of the animal, although the poets never used that phrase.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Christian.
Hello.
I'm good to see everybody again. Yeah.
Well, I have two questions, but it's not in my first language, so I wrote them during your conference. Well, many, many deaf persons are able to realize this kind of poetic structures. They do not need, in fact, to be poets. Or would you have to say that every deaf person is a powerful poet, even if the quality of the performance is very different from one signer to another? The structures are realized by the same way. And the second question, as to deal with the first one, the fact that the deaf performance are immediately, it was very interesting point, immediately included in narrative activity. So why qualify those performance as poetic rather than narrative first, and then more or less poetic?
Okay.
Why have you to qualify these performances as poetic rather than narrative first, and then more or less poetic?
Shall I reply?
Yeah, wait a minute, we're still doing it. Okay, yes.
Okay, thank you. Yes, my response to your first question, the British poet Dorothy Miles, D-O-R-O-T-H-Y, Dorothy Miles, she said that any deaf person who can sign is a potential poet. So there is no doubt that this is indeed a basic part of everybody's sign language. Just as there is a great deal that you could find of poetry in the everyday spoken language of a person, there is indeed a fundamental poetry in the sign language, and it's for people to be thinking poetically who can bring it out. There's no doubt that some signers are particularly skilled at doing this type of signing, this type of highly visual, creative, what Bernard Bragg called the visual vernacular, this moving beyond signs. They are particularly good at it. They're almost like they're born with the skill. But even they need to practice it. They need to refine it. They need to work together. They share ideas. They correct each other. In that group of poets, those four poets you saw, two had a natural tendency to do this kind of thing, and two had to think more about it. So it's partly there in everybody. It's partly that some people are particularly good at it, but even they need to reflect on it and think about it and, yeah, to work at it. So that would be my response to your first question. I don't know, Penny, if you want to add to that before I respond to the second?
No, move on.
Okay. My response to the second You're right, Christian. What do we call this? You can call it creative sign language. You can call it artistic signing. The people we worked with, they call themselves poets. They say they create poetry. From Aristotle, nobody has been able to say what is poetry. Aristotle in ancient Greece. So for thousands of years, we've been trying to decide what is poetry. There are poetic narratives. So there are narratives that are full of this creative, aesthetic, pleasing language. There's a lot of research. Ben Bahan, the interpreter, do you know Ben Bahan?
Ben Bahan, B-E-H-A-N, B-E-H-A-N,
An American deaf poet and storyteller. He's talked about this. Another deaf researcher in America, Peters, Cynthia Peters. She has also talked about this question of, is this poetry? Is this storytelling? Dirksen Bauman, this is his name sign. Also, he's at Gallaudet. He said, maybe this isn't poetry, maybe this is another visual art form altogether that is more like painting, but it moves. So this is what Penny was saying, maybe we bring cinema and film into this. You know, I don't know what to call it. Poetry maybe is just a word that we have handy, but what it describes is something that just deaf people can do that has no equivalent word in English or French or any spoken language. Penny, I don't know if you want to add to that.
No, I think it's a wonderful answer. It just reminded me sometimes with my discussions with my musician husband when they say, what is music? I think sometimes you get the same kind of a problem. I mean, yeah? What, you have to come up here.
I just wanted to add something to this first question of rhythm and spacing. I think part of what makes poetry for us to be poetry hangs together with the timing of things which are different from the narrative. If you tell narrative stories, it's edgier, or I don't know how to say, but I just remember, was it Sharon Newman Solo? In the 1980s, she translated pop songs into sign language. And by observing her, I saw how she was rhyming, for instance, at the ends. She was delaying things, and their movements were much softer and differently connected. And I think this is a very important part that makes poetry, musicalizes poetry, and makes it different from pure narrative.
Okay, yes? Can you see her?
I can't see you. But
yes, she can see you.
Okay.
sorry, I'm lost. It was very interesting to when you said that all the deaf signing persons have this poetic ability. Because you have this, some people can, sorry. I'm going to first sign, then the interpreter will translate my question, because it's difficult for him to translate simultaneously. All the deaf have these poetic-like ability, and as said Cuxac, there are two ways of saying things with formal signs or with or showing things, and with one with a frozen sign, for example. You can change this frozen sign with playing with proforms or classifiers. So depending on what you are able to say, you may use some kind of way of saying things. Some people use this ability to play with frozen signs, and other are able to switch between high iconicity and frozen signs. And so that's just some kind of remark, and then that's all for my question.
I think that's a really interesting comment, and it reminded me of something else which I thought might be an interesting way to approach it, is to find people who don't do sign poetry very well. Most hearing people, probably, like myself, but other people. I know we found, when we looked at conducting gestures, we learned a lot by looking at young people trying to learn conducting, and looking at their mistakes, conducting. And looking at, you say that deaf people can do both, and some are more are better at the artistic sign. But I think it'd be interesting to look at people who aren't so good and say, okay, we know this isn't so good, but why? And you can get at some of the essentials of what's going on by finding out what's not happening here, what's missing. Okay, that was just a random thought. Are there any other comments? Yes?
So I try in English, but you said that, and Rachel as well, said that it's impossible for mimes to have some linguistics features, but now I mean it's possible, but they don't use it. But we have historically we have examples of these kind of things, and especially with Quintilian, is it good in English? Quintilian. Quintilian in French, you know, the Quintilian, Quintilian, who was this senator in Rome, in antique Rome, uh-huh. And Quintilian said, when he spoke about rhetoric, he said you have to avoid to make gestures like mimes do, because mimes at this time mime every word, and we have example of discourse made by or translated by mimes at this moment. So it's possible to have this kind of not really deaf people sign language, but a kind of more near sign language in mime. But it was at this moment, it was a kind of forbidden thing to do. If you have to have a discourse, you have to make the idea and not the word in gesture. So, and historically, it was it is in the Middle Age and in the Renaissance and in the Enlightenment period, it was always the same things. It's a kind of you have to avoid to do that. And I think mimes in this tradition, because mime the European tradition is in fact a French tradition, are completely focused on this point, and they avoid always to make a gesture like a word or like a sign. I mean, so it's an historical fact, but you can have another tradition of mime, and I think in this case we are more linked with sign language, and maybe we can study this kind. You know, you've got a play, you have to describe a word with mime, and I think we have to do this kind of recording to see how people deal with a gesture when they have to explain a concept or a word. And maybe it's another study, but it could be interesting to see this range of gesture possibility. Okay, it was a comment more. Thank you.
What? Yeah, okay. Maybe we should stop for lunch, what do you think? No, I think you're absolutely right, and there are historical, you know, as you pointed out, forms of mime that did use words, and there is sort of charades, I think the word, this game, and there have been some studies, charade. This is my last sentence, I promise the interpreter. So there's lots of studies we can do. Let's have lunch and talk about it. Thank you very much for your attention. And Rachel, thank you so much for getting up and sticking with us, and thank your internet provider for sticking with us. And happy carnival.
Thank you. And thank you all. I've had a really nice time, and my greetings to you all.